W2WKV with information.
Go right ahead, George.
As you know, when W2KPQ, Ed Pillar was building the radio amateur TV repeater, I was given some jobs to do. I helped fabricate the power supply, but the reason I overheard Glenn's comment, your design amplifier was used in that amateur TV repeater, Dick. I wonder if you were aware of that.
Yes, I think I was, George. And I've got a quick question for Glenn. Glenn, you said you're going to go to the 100-watt level. What kind of an amplifier is going to be giving you 100 watts of afterburner amateur television? Solid state or tube? Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm all monolithic and transistor here, Dick. Right now, the bipolar transistor amplifier I'm using, or going to be using, other than being tested into a dummy load, I haven't put it onto an antenna yet. But right now, it's basically a Mirage 1010 amplifier that I was able to pick up off eBay relatively inexpensively. But it's in pretty good shape, and right now, the only modification I had to make on it was there was a little stability RC network that was basically one of those like base collector RCs that I had to lift off, and that kind of gave the amplifier more of a flat gain across the 6 megahertz segment of operation so that I would get the correct level. So I was checking that out, and that seems to work okay so far, but basically right now my transmitter consists of a PCS electronics, which is actually a gentleman in Kosovo who actually built these, and another guy who teamed up with him who's in another Eastern Bloc nation, I'm trying to think. And they make a beautiful 19-inch rack mount case with a nice PLL tuned, tunable, you know, with adjustable power, adjustable frequency transmitter. So basically, that's what I'm using. It's a nice LCD readout. I've got that set up over here now, which is a nice setup. So that with the Mirage amplifier, basically is the setup you get. And it seems to be pretty reliable and pretty thermally stable right now, too.
Okay, your Mirage amplifier, modifying its tuning circuits to give it 6 megs of bandwidth, quite doable. Changing the bias to make it a little bit more linear, quite doable. But one of the disappointments I think you might discover is that no matter what you do with the transistors of the Mirage amplifier, it is capable of a peak envelope power of 100 watts. That's the good news. But it's already 1 or 2 dB into compression when it's putting out 100 watts. And when it comes to compression of a video signal, which will be compressing your sync pulses, because the sync pulses are the strongest portion of the transmitter of a television signal, that's going to be a little bit hard to take. To my knowledge, the majority of guys who have used a Mirage amplifier for an afterburner on ATV usually don't run much more than, I'm going to pick a number, 50, 60 watts of peak envelope power of output because of the compression characteristic. I imagine there's ways of pre-distorting the waveform of modulation going in to compensate for that. I don't know how successful any of the guys have been doing that in the past. Another thing I wanted to mention to you, getting to what George was saying, let me drop. A significant number of guys over the years have definitely run parallel kilowatt amplifiers, a single tube or a double tube for CX250B in video modulation service. And Ed Pillar, W2KPQ, who really was the first technical net, because in 1975, for a little over a year, he ran something called the Limark Amateur Television and Technical Net is what he would call it. And George and I and others would sign in quite frequently with putting in our 2 cents worth. The way guys have done it is so-called low-level modulation. In other words, the RF energy is being applied to the control grid of the 4CX250B in the conventional manner. Then with a very sophisticated bias modulator network, you change the control grid bias on the 4CX250Bs with the video modulation. As a block diagram on paper, it looks pretty simple. When it comes to doing it in reality, because each individual 4CX250B has something like 14 picofarad of control grid capacitance. And with two of them in parallel, you're driving 28 picofarad. And if you then study what's required to get, let me drop, to get 6 megacycles of bandwidth with 28 picofarad of shunt capacitance plus the rest of your circuit, you're probably going to end up with 35 or 40 picofarad altogether of shunt capacitance. To drive 40 picofarads with 6 megacycles of video bandwidth rolls off the tongue easily. To do it with gain linearity, frequency response, group delay distortion, to do it all correctly definitely separates the men from the boys. It requires a little bit of smarts to do it. What some guys end up doing to get around the problem is putting a very large shunt resistor on the control grid bias network to act as a dummy load to shunt away the frequency peaking characteristics of that 28 picofarad. So it's definitely doable. A number of guys have done it, but it requires some sophistication. For a guy like you who has the ability to do computer modeling of networks and by way of pre-distortion and whatever, and gain equalizers and so on, I know you will solve the problem. But the average guy that just wants to follow somebody's schematic diagram, solder some parts together and say, I've got a video modulator, many of those guys in the past ran into a painful situation where they discovered that they're transmitting pretty nice audio, a pretty nice video, but it only went out to half a megacycle of bandwidth, and the pictures were kind of rounded off, if you know what I mean. So that's part of the reason I'm asking you about the afterburner amplifier you've got now and the one you're planning in the future. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick, and understood. Just a quick little, how can I say, a little bit of response on kind of what kind of performance I've gotten so far in the Mirage. So far, it's actually been better than anticipated. I've read a lot of the remarks about the Mirage, and they weren't good. But what's interesting is I've taken a spectrum analyzer, and I've looked at the signal coming directly at low level coming out of the transmitter, and I kind of marked everything to see what the levels were. And then I went back, and I put the Mirage in line, and I turned it on, put it in SSD mode to kind of hold it on, and that didn't work too well. And then what I had to do was just hard key the transceiver, because I didn't want that TR function with RF clicking on and off in transmit mode, because there is some modulation that affects that switch turning it on and off. And once I got that out of the way, then things started looking better. But then I went back to the website where I saw that from Mirage themselves, and they say to remove this 0.1 100 ohm resistor that goes across the transistors. I lifted that off, and sure enough, I had very, very nice performance. Now, the amount of output power that I was getting, I was adjusting the output power coming out of the 5-watt transmitter, and I was moving it up and down. And then what I noticed is that when I went below 60 watts of drive, I didn't get very good performance. As a matter of fact, the signals looked ratty. And then I started driving the amplifier up a little bit, and then I got a very, very nice response, somewhere like around 70 to 75 watts PEB. And it looked good. And then if I went any higher, it started compressing and looked poor again. So there's some kind of a sweet spot on the output that I'm seeing so far where it looks quite usable at about 70 watts. But
K2RIW, KC2, QIQ. Dick, WKV, with another comment before I scoot.
Yeah, go ahead, George. Wait for the beep.
My recollection with your design amplifier, the only problem we had was when Eddie tried to test it in his garage where our shop was a very severe heat problem, and that was my end. I had a design. I had to make a chimney for the 4CX150 that worked effectively, keeping the airflow in contact. When he drove it, it got very, very hot, as my recollection, which is not as accurate as it should be because I'm getting old. Over to you, WA2WKV, and I got a scoot.
Yeah, quite possibly, George. We're using a single 4CX150A with the normal socket driving air through it in a normal manner. In other words, you are pressurizing the lower cabinet, blowing the air through the socket, through a chimney, through the anode of the tube, and then out. And the one of the big advantages, by my standards, of the parallel kilowatt amplifier was that I pressurized not the lower cabinet, but the upper cabinet. Therefore, the air would split, and some of it would go through the anode of the tube, which needed it the most, and out through an upper chimney, and the other half of the air would go down through the socket. And the reason I did that is I rapidly recognized the fact that the amount of blockage of the airflow was greater for the socket than for the anode, which needed it. That was kind of crazy. Am I correct, George, in guessing that you were pressurizing the air into the lower cabinet, which is the very conventional way of using that screen bypass socket on a 4X150, W82WKV, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Dick, my recollection is not strong, but I think we had attempted to run it inverted. And I think, I may be totally in error, I think Ed purchased this particular amplifier from you. It was fabricated originally by yourself. Is my memory right? Before I keep saying before I scoot, I gotta sort things out in my mind.
No. I had a single tube amplifier, which is the so-called amplifier tripler, for 2 meters and 432. And I think for a while I may have used the 4X150 there. No, I didn't. 4CX250B. I never built a single tube 432 straight amplifier. The amplifier tripler strip line circuit that was in Ham Radio Magazine, February 1970, yes. But I never built a single tube straight through amplifier 432, and to my knowledge, I've never sold any of these amplifiers to Ed W2KPQ, one of the founders of Limark. So he may have gotten it, but he didn't get it from me. Back to you, George.
Your memory gets distorted by your own interpretation of events. I'm talking about me. I do remember we ran some heat tests with the tube inverted. For some reason, I had gotten, I had some accurate dial thermometers, Western dial thermometers, which were used. And it didn't improve the situation. I don't my real end in that ATV experiment was really basic hard wiring of the power supply. I don't remember why I got involved in the amplifier, but specifically to do some mechanical work with it. I think we again to invert the tube to try to get better cooling effect, but that did not work out. I'm probably all wet, but that's another game. I'm going to be clear, but good luck, and Glenn, good luck. Try again. Best I can say. K2RIW, WA2WKV.
George, there's some ambiguity of language here. When you say you inverted the tube, I can interpret that in literally, which means you used the tube upside down in some manner, or are you telling me you pressurized the upper cabinet so that now the air split into two paths? One path went down through the aperture of the tube socket and went down and cooled the control grid. The other half of the air went through the anode of the tube through a chimney that's mounted above the tube and then out of the cabinet. That's the so-called parallel air cooling arrangement. You've used the word inverted the tube twice. I'm confused by those words. They seem a bit ambiguous. Back to you, George.
My memories physically turning the tube upside down in operation. I gotta go.
Yeah, that alone would not improve the cooling at all. And maybe that was a misinterpretation of the so-called parallel air cooling arrangement. Bye-bye for now, George. And so, do you believe your Mirage amplifier was running Class A or Class B? I know that the basic barefoot Mirage, I think, runs Class B, B2, or almost C, if you know what I mean, halfway between B and C. So without the proper amount of drive, it would have a significant amount of crossover distortion. as you start forward biasing the transistors of the Mirage amplifier, it starts moving closer to Class A, but now giving the right amount of cooling of the transistors and still getting the right amount of peak envelope power in more Class A service represents a bit of a bind. Getting beyond 60 or 70 watts on what's called a 100 watt amplifier in ATV service, I think, is quite difficult. So what was your standby current, so to speak, of the Mirage amplifier? Over to you, Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, the standby current is really, really low. You know, a few hundred milliamps, I think, max. Because right now I noticed, you know, I wasn't monitoring it directly on the transistor. I was just looking at, you know, like the current meter on my Astron power supply. That if I look at that current meter, it was way down in the mud in the standby mode with low drive. So I didn't see much of any current really being drawn. I would say you're right on the money with it being between B and C, somewhere in that area, very, very near cutoff. But there again, oddly enough, by driving the input power up into the amplifier, as I said, below 60 watts, there's going to be a lot of distortion. It's going to look horrible. But when I was getting 70 watts of output power, with somewhere like around, I would say about somewhere around 4.5 to 5 watts of drive coming out of my transmitter, I was getting very, very good performance on the output, very impressive performance. And the heating on the heat sink of the powers of the Mirage amplifier wasn't all that bad. But when I started increasing the drive a little bit harder to try to get to like 85 watts, then the first thing I started noticing was the heatsink temperature. I was watching my thermocouples, and they were going, they just took off. And then it was right about that time where I saw the picture starting to degrade as well. So there was a sweet spot. Like, without many the only modification I made, Vic, was just taking that RC off of the transistors and then just adjusted the drive level until I started seeing a very, very good picture with about a 70-watt output. So I've kind of marked those drive levels on the frequency 434, and that seems to give me pretty good performance for now. Let me let it drop for a second. My next question for you, Dick, is this is really just to get started here. I'm just getting my feet wet, but I'm very, very interested in using a K2RIW type of transmitter, power amplifier. I guess the real question that I have right now about that is maybe if you could just give me a couple of words on that, like what kind of anticipated output power could I expect in ATV, how much drive power does it need, and is it possible that you might be able to forward me some schematics and things I might need to put them together? If I beg hard enough. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And you're really asking, do I have any schematic diagrams of grid modulators for a pair of 4CX250B? I think the answer is no. There were some classic articles on that exact subject, I think in Ham Radio Magazine. And as an ARRL member, where you can go back to all of the archives of Ham Radio, you will find those articles. The amplifier itself, what you're left-handedly asking me is, what is the peak envelope power capability of that amplifier? And the unasked question is, how much must I back off to get sufficient linearity? A stock 4CX250B pair of tubes strip line amplifier, as in the article, will put out with a little bit less than 20 watts of drive, I think it was like 15 watts of drive, 700 watts of output, 2,000 volts on the plate, half an ampere, close to 70% efficiency, Class C service. So the tubes themselves in that amplifier are capable of easily 700 watts peak envelope power output. Let me drop. You take, for instance, Frank Tona, F9FT, now a silent key. He built a parallel kilowatt amplifier, and he was getting slightly more than 2,000 watts output, key down, out of ordinary 4CX250Bs. I wrote him a letter and say, Frank, how in the world are you doing that? Back came 4 pages, all in French, which I had translated, and the answer was a whole lot of B-plus voltage on the plate, a whole lot of voltage on the screen, a whole lot of drive, and a whole lot of air. He was pushing the daylights out of the tubes. But 4CX250Bs, if you move enough air through them, can be abused like you wouldn't believe. They're rated 250 watts of plate dissipation. Move enough air through those tubes, they will easily dissipate 500 watts per tube. So that's not a problem. As long as you're careful in the way you keep track of the screen grid current so that you don't exceed 12 watts in any screen grid, they will last forever. And something like 2 watts of dissipation on the control grid, don't exceed that, and they'll last forever. After that, a good healthy set of tubes, particularly the 4CX250R version, the slightly ruggedized version, which has got a little more mechanical support inside. Let me drop. And I believe a slightly beefier cathode will do it. 2,000 watts output. My guess is with the way he was running those tubes, you could get 1,500 watts peak envelope power output with reasonable linearity. You may have to do some pre-distortion in order to make it all come out linear, but those tubes are capable of doing it. So the biggest variable in what power output that tube can give, you would think it's the plate voltage. It's the screen voltage. The main thing that limits your peak envelope power output is peak current capability of the tube. The peak current capability of the tube is a function of screen grid voltage to the 3/2 power. Take whatever voltage you've got on the screen grid, raise it to the 3/2 power before and after you change the screen grid voltage, and that will tell you what ratio of peak current the tube can give, and that's the major limitation on what peak power output you can get. So I do know that when it comes to extreme linearity without using pre-distortion, when it comes to extreme linearity, the 3CX100A5 with grounded grid service is what K1FO, Steve Polishin, favors, because the average guy running moonbound service just drives the living daylights out of an amplifier, would like it to be linear in sideband service. They got drive up the kazoo to work with, and so grounded grid linear does give them greater linearity. But for a guy of your smarts, you don't have to go through all that extra drive, all those extremely expensive tubes. I think a 3CX100A5 tube, 3CX800A5, I think it is, the 800 watt dissipation tubes, very expensive socket, very expensive tube. I don't think you got to go there. 4CX250Bs on the surplus market, you used to be able to get them for $5 a piece, and they last forever as long as you don't agree.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They last forever as long as you don't exceed, as long as you don't abuse the control grid. So your biggest challenge, as I see it, would be to find an article that's capable of giving you the grid modulator at a 6 megacycle rate driving, let's say, 30 picofarads. And as I remember, some of those articles used push-pull transistors to drive the capacitance both in the positive and negative direction. To just use a pure dummy load resistor to do that with single-ended drive transistors is a tougher way to go. You're going to be dissipating some power in that control grid bias network in order to get the right linearity and the right amount of frequency response. So the real smarts is there. High-level plate modulation with video, to my knowledge, no one has ever done it. The DVDT is just such a huge number that it's out of the question. To swing 2,000 volts in 1 over 6 megacycles of time, which is some number of nanoseconds, is out of the question. But if you could do it, my goodness, would that be an interesting-looking amplifier. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Some information, WHCDL.
Okay, Eric and Andy in that order. Eric, go ahead.
Well, there has never been a commercial transmitter that tried to do high-level modulation in video. It's not impossible, but there's just too many problems with it. If he really wants to make a lot of video, and by the way, nobody ever thinks about pre-distortion, because when it is you make the amplifiers, if you really want to make good video, there's some tricks to it. And it's pretty simple to do, but in all the amateur TV stuff, nobody has even bothered to approach it. But if you want to build 1,000 watts, that's really good video. All you need is 6 MRF 151s, I've got a really good circuit. They work very well. 50 volt supply. It's actually pairs of transistors in the package. They're designed for video service, and that's what the commercial transmitters use.
Okay. Comment.
Okay, comment recognized. You're going to be right after Andy. When it comes to those particular transistors, because Glenn is a strong, solid-state enthusiast, I'll bet you he's going to be taking your approach. Andy,
safe bet, Dick.
I kind of thought so. For you to build a 2,000-volt, half-ampere power supply would bug you a little bit compared to these nice, instant-heating, transistorized things with gallium nitride and whatever. Andy, please give us your information. And what is the call letters of that other guy on the South Shore of Long Island who is also on amateur television, W2EI something or other? W2CDL, H2RAW on the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, guys. Eric, Dick, and Glenn. All the guys that are into ATV, and there's a comment also. First of all, Eric, just for you, the repeater was not in the net mode at 8 o'clock when it started. I had to put it in manually. I think the time clock may be off, although I didn't hear it announce the time. To let you know. So it's in the net mode now, which means the PL is turned off. There was some problems in the beginning. And Dick, as you know, I was active in ATV in the 80s. And it was a homebrew station. We started off with these RCA CMU-15s, which was a commercial transmitter. That there was a whole bunch of them. In fact, I think Ed Pillar had one and was using it at his home. And I think it was the foundation or main exciter for the repeater, if I'm not mistaken. I may be wrong about that. I thought maybe he was using the CMU-15. Anyway, I originally started off with that, but then I decided to use that to drive a 4CX250B amplifier, which I took out of service when I worked for Motorola, and I grid modulated that. And the reason why I'm mentioning is that I have that schematic. If you ever want to build a video modulator for a 4CX250B, I have the schematic for it. I also have the schematic and the QST article of your amplifier, your strip point amplifier, Dick, that you designed, so I can always dig that up because I have QSTs.
Repeater, timeout.
Did I time out just to let you know?
Yeah, about 15 seconds of time out, so give us the last 15 seconds again, Andy.
Okay, I gotta remember not to talk too long. I was saying about the 4CX250B amplifier. There's a couple of cautions that you have to do. Oh, let me just backtrack. I did mention that I have the QST article for your strip line amp, Dick, so I can give that to Glenn if he wants to build one. And I also have the video modulator for 4CX250B amp because I built one. And I have all my schematics. So, if you missed that part, that's what I said. As far as the 4CX250B amp, there's a couple of precautions that you have to be aware of with these tubes. And some of them you already mentioned. Let me let it drop again. All right, cooling is very important. If it's not cooled properly, if you don't have good airflow, you're going to destroy the tube rather quickly. And I know you mentioned that, but it can't be overemphasized that you have to have good airflow on that amplifier, especially for the service of that video service that you're using it for. And I had plenty of cooling in mine. And the other thing that's critical is the filament voltage. Filament voltage on 4CX250, if I recall, is 5 volts. Regulated. It is critical on the tolerance of that voltage on the filament of that tube. I even made a circuit to regulate the filament supply to keep it stable. Grid biasing, you already mentioned. Screen voltage regulation is also a must if you want to keep the plate current. Because, like you said, plate current is dependent on screen voltage. You want to keep that constant. If you're running two tubes, you want to keep the plate current equal, which I did. I made an equalization circuit and a few other things. So I just wanted to add that to your amplifier or any 4CX250 amp as a footnote. Go ahead, Dick. I hope I didn't time it.
No, you didn't. No problem, Andy. What were the call letters of the other guy on amateur television other than W2OTA and the other group that we mentioned? A W2EI something? What's his handle and call letters?
All right, there were two ATV stations that are active that besides W2OTA. And the guy in Massapequa is Ed W2WIA. And he's basically not a neighbor of Glenn. And there's another guy, George, and I forgot his call, it's a KB2 call. He's up in Plainview. He was on tonight. And he's not been on that often because he works nights. But tonight he was off from work, so he was on. So you got George from Plainview, and you got Ed, W2WIA from Massapequa, and the other two guys. Go ahead. We also have, as a footnote, WB2AZQ in Long Branch, New Jersey. His name is Tom. He's active also. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, Long Branch, New Jersey. I believe you've tried getting signals from Long Branch or sending signals to him, and so far things are a little bit noisy. Is that true, Andy? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just barely saw him with the setup that I have now. And I'm going to change that around. First of all, I got to get the antenna up on the higher tower. I got to change the antennas. I got to change the feed line. And a few other things. But when I lived in Merrick and I had the those antennas up, which was the EX420s, I had four of them. The same antennas that Joe Espanti used. So Joe Espanti's call was WB2AQM in New Hyde Park. He works for Sperry, by the way. Same antennas he used. He had a great signal. And along with everyone else that was on active, W2TYA, W2ORM, W2JVN, and W2EWC, Uncle Willie, ACW, who was up at World Trade the day of the attack, and the list goes on and on of all the guys that were active, but unfortunately that are gone now. Go ahead.
When you said W2TYA, did you mean W2OTA? Over to you.
No, W2TYA was Merle Theresen, also a Line Mark member, and he was active.
Is he still active?
No, he's a silent key as well.
Understand. Okay. Long Branch, New Jersey. Is there a gaggle of guys on amateur television in New Jersey? And is there a group in the Hartford, Connecticut area? To your knowledge, Andy, go ahead.
There's one guy in Hartford, I forget his call. And I don't know if he's set up. And as far as New Jersey, I don't know. There's another guy in the Coney Island, Brooklyn area, who I've yet to hear on the air. He's not been on yet. But Tom in Long Branch has been calling him. So, eventually, he will get on. I understand he has a good setup as well. So, the bottom line to all this is trying to keep ATV active. The two guys, Mike and Ed, they're both in their mid-80s. And George, they're the last of the Mohegans, Unfortunately, things happen, who's left? We've got to keep the band active. So maybe some newcomers will help out.
One last question. Do you remember the guy, a K2 blank, 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 lived in Amityville, Long Island, big on amateur television in the mid-70s, way back in the dark ages, and during the flooding that used to occur in front of his property, he would send ATV pictures of what the flooding was like. Do you remember his name or call letters, Andy? You probably were on amateur television back at that time. Back to you, Andy.
No, I was not into ATV, but Al, the guy you're thinking of, Al Lush, K2RYT, was the chief engineer at WGBB, 1240 AM, where the studio was in Merrick, and I lived in Merrick. And Al used to be a big bunny hunter. He used to come out on the hunt on 10 meters with us. That's how I know Al. And, yeah, he was active in ATV, along with Frank Larkin, W2ORM, out in Iceland. And Frank is a silent key also. Probably knew Frank. And you mentioned Al. Al is still active on the air. Actually, not this airways. He's still DJing for a radio station out in Stag Harbor. If you tune in on your AM or FM dial, you can hear his voice. He's still active. Back to you.
I presume he doesn't live in Amityville anymore?
Still does.
How about that? Okay. But he's not on amateur television anymore, is what I think you're saying.
No, he's been out of it for many years, along with transmitter hunting. Yeah, that's it. That basically gives you the rundown. And I have a lot of articles and things that I've collected over the years. I was not involved in Limewalk when Limewalk had the ATV repeater up on the Diocese Tower up in Thiasset. Unfortunately, it was short-lived for whatever the reason. But I understand it worked quite well. And again, Ed had a CMU-15 at his house with one single DX-420 20-element collinear beam. Those beams, by the way, is what I used, and they worked very well. I was not that high up as far as tower height, and considering where I was located, I was a little in the valley. It worked quite well. So I was very pleased with the performance of those antennas.
Yeah, when you get a chance, I'm going to turn it back to you to find out what antennas Mike W2OTA is running now. There was a person, and thank you for all of that ATV information. Good stuff. There was a person who said he had a comment about all of the above. Please give me your call letters, your name, and then your comment, sir. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. This is Ed, K2GJE.
Go right ahead, Ed, and tell us your comment.
In the mid-50s, when I first got on the air, W2OMU was building amateur television. All the black boxes didn't exist like today, and he was building all the sync generator circuits with tubes. And he did broadcast amateur television for a while from New Canaan, Connecticut, and then I believe he moved down to Tennessee. But he was quite the expert. You might check QRZ to see if he's not a silent key. Over.
Very good, Ed. Do you happen to remember his handle, W2OMU? Go ahead.
Yes, I can give you his full name. His name is Arnold Proner. Arnold Proner is his full name. Over.
Okay, good to know. Arnold Proner. P-R-O-N-E-R. Is that the way it's spelled, Ed?
Correct, to the best of my knowledge. W2OMU.
Interesting. Oh, boy. So back in the 50s, there was television. That's the early days of over-the-air broadcast television. Yeah, Al Lush, K2RYT. Back in those days, on 439.25 megacycles, it was the wide-open spaces, and he wasn't creating any interference. But occasionally, he would show us scenes of the floods that occurred in front of his house in Amityville, and softly in the background, you'd hear the music of Surfing USA. It's a good combination. He also had what in the 70s was considered a portable camera, something you could mount on your shoulder with a great big long umbilical cord, and it probably was 15 pounds of hardware. Let me drop. And he would go walking through his house with the television camera operational, transmitting through the tower on 439 megacycles. So you literally lived his life. In other words, you could picture yourself inside of his body as he's walking around the house. You'd see the hands reaching out in front of the camera, grabbing things that he's picking up to show you, showing you his living room, his dining room. There's his cat, there's his dog, and so on. It was fun stuff. Then he would walk outside with this great big long umbilical cord on the camera and show you where the tower was, and then aim the camera up at the tower, at the top of the tower, and you were looking at the antenna that was transmitting the signal to you. Fun type stuff. Of all the things Al did, the one thing I never saw was a picture of Al. I wasn't able to talk him to walk over to a mirror where he aimed the camera into the mirror so I could see what he looked like. I never saw a picture of Al. He and I probably were at the same flea market from time to time and never knew what each other looked like. Anybody with any further information about the subject of A5, as it's called, amateur television, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW. No, Jake.
I heard Eric. Who was the other person?
Me, N2EO.
Okay, N2EO in that order. Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, just a little tidbit of information for you guys that are interested in knowing what your peak power is if you're transmitting ATV. There's a very simple way to do it. I could actually break it down into how it comes out that way, but well, if you're using a bird watt meter, you're actually reading average power. If you want to know what the peak power is, the method that the FCC used to require is you multiply that reading by 1.68 and you'll get the peak power. And that actually takes into consideration, and this is for NTSC, it's not for PAL, and a properly created NTSC signal with all the pre and post equalizers, all the synchronizing lines that are taken into consideration. So that's the magic number. And there is actually an excellent ATV publication, and while I was at Dayton, actually I got to show you some of the video that I took of the DARA ATV repeater setup, which is really cool. The guy from the California ATV network, let me let it drop. There's a magazine called ATV Quarterly. Actually, I have it in the bathroom. I have to go get it. It's published four times a year. In California, the ATV network runs all up and down the coast. But DARA, the people who run the Dayton Hamvention, actually a few years back had acquired an AT&T repeater tower site, which they built into the clubhouse, beautiful facility. And their ATV repeater is situated there. There's another sister ATV repeater in Columbus. They're linked together. They have multiple inputs at various different parts of the town. It's quite an interesting group of guys who put this together. I actually gave them a whole lot of video stuff, which made them very happy. And give me a second. I'll give you the address and the call sign of the guy in California if you're interested in ATV Quarterly. K2RIW, K2JET.
I have one footnote also.
Okay, you're right after Rich. Should we give you a little bit of time to go get that information and let Rich talk in the meantime? Eric, go ahead. Yeah, Rich, N2EO, go right ahead with your information. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. No, when you mentioned the station and you looked up at his antenna turning and you could see the antenna that was transmitting the signal, that brought back memories of Joe Visconti. Visconti, I'm not sure how he pronounced his name. He's no longer with us. Lived in, was it New Hyde Park, I think Joe lived? AQM, I believe it was called. He would come on, and he had a cell phone built into the wall with a big map. It was about 1977, 78. And he had four of these DX420 collimators, 80 elements. And as he turned the antenna your way, you'd see that pointer come over like Whitestone, Queens, and he'd come up out of the noise. And he had one of the best signals I ever saw on ATV. In fact, Dick, he had a grid modulated K2RIW amplifier. Joe was probably
has the best. He looked like NBC, except he was black and white. I mean, the cover was a big deal then. But he had everything homebrew. I think the only thing he had in the shack that wasn't homebrew was the Hamlin receiver. Back to that, until we up.
I'm back. Very fine. Yeah, I do remember Joe Rusanti very well with WB2AQM. Interesting character. He's also heavy into model airplanes, and he had one of the very first Academy of Model Aeronautics licenses for radio-controlled model aircraft. You've heard Eric talk about DARA quite a few times. D-A-R-A stands for Dayton Amateur Radio Association. Go ahead, Eric, with your information. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right. It's called ATV Quarterly. That's ATV Quarterly, and their website is atvquarterly.com, and it's really run by two guys. Bill Brown, which is the balloon guy, W-B-A-E-L-K, he's the publisher and manager. And Mike Collis, which is W-A-6-S-V-T, is the technical editor. It's a good magazine. It's, you know, published four times a year. It's pretty cheap. I think it's like $20. And anything or anyone that's doing anything ATV, it's a great magazine to have. Interestingly enough, the Dara folks are very much into it, and the Columbus folks are actually doing digital ATV. Now, ever since I came back from Dayton, I've been pushing a few people at Zenith, or actually LG. They finally came up with a chipset that I've been looking for, because what I want to do is put together 8 VSB and TV, make it affordable for people, because it's rather a complex issue. And the way I've got it now, if we go out and buy the stuff, the cheapest stuff that I can find to make it work would cost the average hand probably around $1,200. But with this chipset, which is one part of it, I can get it down to around $200. But then we also have to have the encoding part of it. And the interesting thing is today's modern receivers will, you know, tune from channel 53 to 56 cable. Cable normally is QAM, but what I've found is that these receivers don't care. What they do is they sense what's coming in, and they switch their decoder to whatever is coming in. So,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You timed out the last 10 seconds where you talked about that the receiver will take either kind of modulation and figure it all out. Amazing if the Columbus Group is into 8 VSD or digital television. And so by way of those chipsets that you're talking, Zenith, and you mentioned another company are going to be building, I think you're saying a guy could start transmitting digital television for $200 as opposed to the $1,200 it would take now. And I presume the advantage of digital television is that a smaller amount of radiated power will give you similar range if you have control of multipath. You might want to send a couple of words on that one. On top of that, when it comes to portable digital television, I hear tell that at least in the Midwest, the CVS stores, consumer value stores, a drug chain, is selling a fairly nice, I think it's a 5-inch diagonal solid-state color digital television set for under $90. And so quite a few people are buying those. I don't know if it's sold locally, but my friend WA5VJB, Kent Britton in the Dallas area, has run into one of those. Apparently they were very popular, being sold at the last Dayton convention. May have some comments on all of the above, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beep and look out for your watch.
And KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. Eric first.
All right, there's a number of companies now manufacturing, which you can buy at Walmart, and also at Best Buy, they have one of the portables. The prices range from, like, I've heard $90 to, you know, $150, so. But now they're coming out with enhanced VSB, MHE VSB, and there have been a number of stations in the Midwest, in the Chicago area, and a few other places that have joined forces and created an entire lineup sharing this spectrum space so that you could now have a mobile digital receiver and be driving with it and not have it unlock on you. And it actually works. The Columbus group is transmitting digital in the form of DVBS, which is based on the German group, actually the Swedish group, that took a couple of FPGAs and designed their own DVBS system, one card being an MPEG encoder, the other card being the DVBS transmitter, which is QPSK. I'm going to drop. So, typically, the prices of stuff is coming down even in the commercial world because the low-power broadcaster, a typical exciter and MPEG encoder is now down to around $7,000, so it is getting there. But I think I have a solution that'll put it well under $1,000, so that's my story. Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, just a couple of quick comments. One is that for the receive end, to whether you want to receive, 70 centimeters on the digital, analog, virtually any mode of TV that's out there, those little hot pod converters that can be purchased and be used for USB, I had a very, very good experience with that recently, testing it by listening to the local ETV stations on 70 centimeters, and found that if you tuned the software when you're setting up the channels manually between channel 57 to channel 62 with cable input, in other words, you just tell the software to search for cable channels between 57 to 62, that covers basically the 420 through 450 band, and it will lock generally like on 434 somewhere like right around channel 58 or 59. Sometimes it catches it on one or the other. But interestingly enough, it does lock right on. It is in between those channels, but it does tune. There again, so if you just want to view it on a laptop or a powerful desktop machine, it will generally give you the video. And it's basically just a small $49 converter dick. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
Dick, I have to leave the car. I just want to make one comment before I go.
Go right ahead, Andy.
Okay, and then, again, thanks, I have to leave in about a minute or so. Just to mention, anyone, my suggestion is anyone that's getting into ATV for the first time, there's a lot, especially with the two-type amplifiers as we were talking about, there's a lot of adjustments to be made on a two-type amp to get the linearity and bandwidth that's required for full video with color. And my suggestion is, as Eric mentioned, as prices are coming down on test equipment and other accessories and devices, is to construct or obtain a video demodulator, which will be like an RF demodulator section that will go between the transmitter and the antenna, which will pick off the video, demodulate the video from the RF, and feed that into a waveform monitor, and you can pick yourself up an NTSC generator, which I have, which will produce color bars as a reference point, as a standard, so you can look at your stair step waveform along with your 3.58 meg color burst coming out of your transmitter and adjust your transmitter for the proper waveform. That's really the best way to do it. And you could see actually and exactly how your transmitters and amplifiers are performing, rather than going by feel and asking the station, how do I look? The best way is with equipment, with some test equipment, and it's readily available. NTSC is all over the place. It's easy to find. Color bar generator is easy to find, and you could build up a nice little test equipment monitoring.
Repeater, timeout.
You only timed out a couple of seconds that time, Andy. Good information.
Sir?
Go ahead.
All right. The proper method in which to do that, because you'd have to calibrate your CMOD. It's something called a zero carrier pulse that we used to use in the broadcast industry. And that's basically, we blast a half a line out, which makes a little pulse, which actually, on an IRE scale, gives you 120 IRE. You adjust your DMOD to that, because don't forget the video is inverted. And from that, you can actually calibrate your receiver, and from that, you can actually accurately calibrate your transmitter.
Let me go a couple of steps back here, Eric. You said if I multiply 1.68 times the apparent wattage that I read off a bird wattmeter, it's telling me amateur television peak and below power. I presume that's with some form of standard picture. I think that answer would change quite a bit if I was transmitting a pure white or a pure black picture. Isn't that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Oh, that's absolutely positively true. The actually I should have said is that you transmit a signal without burst, okay, and without setup. That means it's blanking that you're transmitting, and that number, 1.67 and 1.68, will actually give you your peak power. And that's actually how the FCC required you measured it.
So, you said without setup. That, does that mean that you're transmitting sort of a grayscale picture? Go ahead.
Negative. Okay. In NTSC, okay, we have sync. We have something called blanking. We have something called setup. And we have something called peak white. Okay. Setup, now, let me start earlier than that. We have to look at a waveform monitor. That waveform monitor is actually broken up into something called IRE. Okay. The IRE units, International Radio Electronic Units. It's a very old standard. All right. And if you look at that scope, the graticule markings go from minus 40 to zero, and you'll see a little dashed line at 7.5 millimeters up, and it will continue upwards to the top of the scale, and it will read 100 at the top. The video portion, or the picture information, will be between the 7.5 and the 100. That 7.5 level we actually call setup. Okay, that is the black level that we use for the picture information. The line of zero will be called blanking, and the minus 40 will be the amplitude of the sync. So what you're essentially sending is just sync to that zero line, which is 0.4 of a volt, sorry. So you have the sync pulses, which are 0.4 of a volt, no burst, no color information, and just blanking. And that's the signal you use to find out your peak power.
If I was watching a picture at that time, would I see a pretty dark picture?
If you what? What picture at the time? Because in essence, you're not sending any picture.
I know I'm not sending any picture. But if I was looking at that transmission over the air, and I looked at my television screen, would it look gray, darkish?
No, it would be blacker than black, meaning that your screen would be completely cut off, and if it's your television is operating properly, you'll see the gray color of the phosphor.
Okay, I understand. So that's a near maximum power output capability during that measurement. As I start transmitting a picture that's more and more white, the true average power coming out would be decreasing. Is that true?
Absolutely correct, which actually comes to a zero, as I told you, a zero reference pulse, or a zero power reference pulse, which is actually what you do. You take a flip-flop or a little multivibrator, and you adjust it to be like a half a line wide, and a half the sync pulse wide, and you actually insert that in the line, and you in essence make the transmitter transmit no output, which then actually becomes the maximum 120 IRE units of information when you demodulate it, because it is a zero carrier. It means no carrier there. Because the system is inverted, it makes white that goes beyond the 1 volt, actually, because of this standard that we use for transmission.